All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 19th day of April, 2023. I've titled today's show, Can Gold Prices Rise in a Recession? My guests today are John Rubino, who is very well known in the show, of course, and libertarian economist, Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. And I'm happy to tell you that John is with me right now. Thank you, John. Thanks for joining me once again.
Hey, Jay, good to see you again.
You know, before we get started, the question of the day, can gold rise during a recession? I would like to have you comment on a few of your recent articles. I mean, they're just, you're writing on Substack now, John, and really enjoying them, I must say. I am a subscriber, a paid subscriber, and I'm happy to pay the, I think it's $50 a year or something like that, John. Very, very modest price and a lot of good stuff there. But some of the things you wrote about, very interesting. You have a series, People We Should Know. And one that you recently wrote about was Dr. Ron Paul, who I used to know very well. I used to be, have him on this show actually quite often in the past. Can you share the main points of Dr. Paul and why he's someone everybody should know? I mean, a lot of the people watching this show most certainly do know Ron Paul already, but just maybe comment on that and maybe a couple of the other people that you've highlighted recently, if you care to.
Sure. Well, you know, I do think that most of my subscribers know who Ron Paul is. So what I posted this time was more of an homage, you know, just a kind of a thank you to him. And what reminded me to do that was that I was on Amazon the other day and I saw a t-shirt for sale with a picture of Ron Paul and it said, "If I told you so was a person," because in other words, he's been right about everything for like 50 years.
Yes,
because Ron Paul isn't somebody who grew into his persona. He seems to have been fully formed as a libertarian thinker from birth. Just about, there are all these videos of him as a pretty young man. I would guess late 20s. Saying basically the same stuff he said in the presidential campaigns that he ran and probably what he's saying right now.
Yes.
And had we listened and done what he said we should be doing all along, we'd be so much healthier now. You know, we should have just canceled the Federal Reserve, you know, strangled it in its crib as soon as we had a chance.
Yeah.
And stayed with the gold standard, stayed with sound money, limited the size of government, and emphasized individual freedom in all of our public policy, we would be in so much better shape than we are right now. You know, because right now we're basically a dying experiment, a failed experiment in fiat currency, where, you know, we're headed off a financial cliff in the not too distant future. So so Ron Paul is definitely somebody we all should know, but unfortunately he's somebody we should have known a lot sooner and should have listened to a lot sooner. So that's a the people you should know, or the people we should know series is one that I'm having a lot of fun writing, because it's a complicated world. And there are some very smart people out there who make it easier to understand what's going on. So to the extent that we know those guys and we're following their work, we're in a lot better shape with a lot clearer understanding of the world than we would be otherwise.
Yeah, no question. And so that's sort of the criteria you use, I guess, for picking people that you should know. It's like, what do they bring to us in terms of understanding the world we live in, I suppose, right? That's what you're trying to do. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Ron, you know, he's of course a libertarian as well, of course, and he understands the connection between honest money and our freedoms and our liberties. And obviously there were people, Ron was a candidate for president. He got the big stage, but you could just see the mainstream media. I remember one anchor on CNN was saying, well, gee, this guy might actually win and we can't have that. And it was a neocon, because Ron has always been about mind your own business internationally. Don't go over and try to overthrow governments and change, trade with them, have business with them, but don't try to overthrow their governments or take them by military conquest or whatever. Mind your business at home, have honest money, honest weights and measures, and then we'll all be better off. And you and I understand this, but I must say, and I want to talk to Dr. Mark Thornton in the second segment of today's show, why it is that people don't understand the connections between honest money, John, and our freedom and our liberty and our happiness. I mean, the ideals of our country was that we are each individuals with something unique to offer. And if we're under a totalitarian state, we can't do that, right?
Yeah, the only sustainable, possibly successful kind of culture is one where the free individual and that person's family are the main units,
right,
that public policy addresses. So we make sure that people are as free as possible and able to pursue whatever they define as happiness and whatever they define as the welfare of themselves and their families without interfering with other people's rights. Then you get a society where there's individual initiative because you're working for something that really matters to you.
Right.
And there's free assembly where people choose what groups they want to be part of. And so institutions form organically through that process. And they're staffed by people who actually really care about the subject and who put a lot of energy and effort into it. And that's the kind of world that we don't have now. You know, the government handles so much of everything for everybody that we no longer feel like we're in charge of our own lives. And more and more, we're not, you know, we're because of unsound money, governments have basically unlimited credit cards that they're able to use to expand in every direction. And that inevitably leads to, you know, a partnership between government and big corporations, right, that forms kind of an aristocracy, mm-hmm, that takes away the individual liberty that used to define our culture. And that's where we are now. We're kind of living in a quasi-aristocracy, mm-hmm, in which the rules don't apply to the top 1%. Yeah. And they're hatching plans for the next level of authoritarianism here. And I think that the next decade or so is probably our last chance to head that off. Otherwise, we're going to be a culture in which the government controls our money completely. Our bank accounts will be with the Federal Reserve, mm-hmm, where they're allowed to surveil us. You know, no matter what the Constitution says, they're allowed to spy on us in any way they want to.
Yeah.
And they're able to punish us for doing things like speaking out against government policy. So we're already in a world that is characterized by endless war and growing authoritarianism, but we haven't seen anything yet. It's going to get a lot worse unless we step up in a hurry to do something about it.
John, the economic arrangement that you just talked about is more akin to fascism. I mean, when capital is owned by large corporations and they're in bed with government, that's really the definition. I mean, that the communist system has government owning all the capital, all the assets, right? That is, the government owns it allegedly for society as a whole, but we know it's the people at the top. The people at the top that really enjoy the fruits of the labor of the slaves below. So either system is pretty much alike. Would you agree?
They're variants of an aristocracy,
yeah,
basically, where you have a small group of people who have all the power and are able to impose their will on everybody else. It almost doesn't matter what kind of, you know, what the outward trappings of the economic system are,
right,
if it's controlled by 1% of the population. And we we're so close to that now. You know, I don't know what else we would really have to do to say that we're completely there, because there really is a small group of people that you could call an aristocracy.
Yeah.
That is in control of virtually everything, and the rest of the country could be called serfs and peasants, you know. Yeah. And we've got some high-tech trappings, you know. It looks a little different than the old aristocracy was, but it's run along the same lines.
Yeah.
So again, we really need to do something about this, and we need to do it in a hurry.
Yeah, and what's really frightening is that President Biden is moving very rapidly. He seems to want to put into effect the CBDCs, that's the digital currencies, the central bank digital currencies, right? And that would give the government then the potential to shut off your supply of resources, essentially, if you don't obey the government, as they have in China, right?
Yeah, basically in a CBDC system where central banks replace the community banks where we have our checking accounts and things like that. Our account is with the Fed, and the Fed can not only see everything we're doing, but they can control the nature of the money. They can program our money.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if they don't think we're spending enough and the economy is not growing as fast as they want, they can put an expiration date on the money that's in our Fed account.
Mm-hmm.
And make it lose 5% of its value every month or whatever, to force us to spend money. If they don't like the things we're spending money on, they can ban us from doing that. If they don't like, for instance, our political activities, if we're opposing the latest war, the Fed can just empty our bank account out. And there's nothing we can do about it, because, you know, we could call the police, but they are the police.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're creating something that's very similar to the social credit score system, like you said, in China,
yeah,
where they keep track of everything you do over there, and they give you a score that that represents how good a citizen you are.
Yeah.
And if you don't score high enough, in other words, if you don't obey the government in every aspect of their policy, they won't let you fly first class, or they won't let you fly at all. They won't let you travel to different places. They won't let you have an apartment. And so that's kind of the thing that the current government in the U.S. is trying to put into place. And it's
frightening.
Yeah, it's terrifying, because once in place, it's going to be really hard for any kind of an opposition to coalesce, because it's going to be against our financial interests to do so. So we're going to have self-censorship, knowing that we could lose our bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
If we say anything that's out of line. So, yeah. And it's possible that the next banking crisis that happens, and we are headed for potentially a big banking crisis here because of commercial real estate blowing up,
yeah,
and taking the insurance companies and the banks down with it. They could use that as an excuse to basically get rid of most of the smaller banks and migrate most of the depositors from smaller banks over to a Fed account. You know, so this is something that could happen in the next year or two.
Yeah.
Because of what's happening with commercial real estate. So we're just about there, Jay, you know.
Yeah, well, whatever excuse they can find to consolidate power to the hands of the few. And this was, of course, what our founding fathers fought the Revolutionary War against, was, you know, a king that could do whatever he wanted. And of course, now the powers of government are so much more efficient now with the technologies available that it is downright frightening. And so, you know, it's about education, John. If people don't understand the connections that we're talking about here, and that's really, you know, Dr. Thornton, when he comes on, we'll talk about that. That's the education the Mises Institute is trying to provide. Ron Paul, of course, very much a part of that school of thought. Free markets, honest money is really at the crux of it. I should just mention, you also have a series called The Art of Collapse. I mean, along the lines of what we were just talking about, John, and the totalitarian government, the future of a totalitarian government. It is downright frightening. But these are things that I think people should be aware of. And I'm happy that you are bringing it to the attention of people. I'm happy that you have to write these articles about these systems that are evolving. But you mentioned commercial real estate, and you recently wrote an article about it. Commercial real estate, a crash or something like that isn't coming. It's here. So what you're saying is it's starting now, John, that commercial real estate bubble is starting to collapse.
Yeah. Well, basically what happened was over the last 10 years, we've had artificially low interest rates.
Right.
Which makes it really easy to finance an office building or an apartment complex or a warehouse or whatever. So a lot of those things got built that, you know, in a normal interest rate environment, probably wouldn't have been built. So we got an oversupply of a lot of commercial real estate. And then meanwhile, in the case of office buildings, the lockdowns that flowed from the COVID pandemic had a lot of people working at home, and people have realized they like working at home. They don't want to go back into an office. And so some huge number, I don't want to repeat the number because I think I misunderstood it, but it's a big number of the workforce now that is working from home. And that means office buildings are emptier than they would be otherwise, which makes them less profitable. Now, meanwhile, a lot of the stuff that got built has to be refinanced. The debt that was taken on to build it is coming due and it's got to be refinanced, but interest rates are way up. So it's got to be refinanced at higher numbers, higher interest rates, which makes it all way less profitable. Yeah. So what's happening now is a lot of office buildings and to an extent apartment buildings are being put up for sale. And they're not selling at the original price. So a lot of them are being pulled back off the market and then reintroduced at a way lower price, you know, from $600 million down to $300 million, and they're still not selling. So there are massive embedded losses in the portfolios of the banks that finance this real estate and the insurance companies that help finance the real estate. So when a lot of these buildings finally do sell and those losses become realized, everybody's going to have to report them. And so it's going to make, for instance, bank earnings look horrendous. And it's going to make a lot of insurance companies look possibly unable to cover the obligations of their policyholders. And that's likely to be a crisis because it's, in the case of the banks, you know, if they report bad earnings, then their depositors pull their money out.
Yeah.
Which forces the banks to sell even more depreciated property, which makes them report an even bigger loss and so on. And you get this kind of doom loop going where each part of the process makes the others look worse and sends these banks just off a cliff. And the government will have to step in and bail them out.
Yeah.
So then that shifts the pressure over to the currency. If there's another $2 trillion bailout, what does that do to the dollar? And so we've got a very big problem coming, beginning with commercial real estate, flowing through the banking system and then to the currency markets.
Right.
And that's our next couple of years, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, it's bail-ins now instead of bailouts, John. So that's where the CBDC thing could come into play, I suppose, so that, you know, they won't let you take your money out necessarily. You know, now we still can, and people are. They're taking their monies out of these smaller banks to a certain extent. Of course, they're getting nice treasury yields right now. I mean, we've done that. Mrs. Taylor and I have taken some money out of the bank and put it into treasuries. Makes sense. But if the banks don't have money, and they're certainly going to protect the banks, I would think, or the central banks are going to be protected. I'm not sure even about the big guys, John, eventually. What are your thoughts?
Well,
like J.P. Morgan's Citicorps and those guys.
They're a separate problem because right now, let's say we're still focusing on real estate. That's a problem of the regional and local banks that tend to take in deposits and then lend that money out to real estate and other things in their areas. The big banks have basically morphed into gigantic hedge funds. They're basically taking every kind of risk imaginable. And a lot of that shows up on their derivatives books.
Yeah.
Some of these big banks, for instance, Deutsche Bank over in Germany has a derivatives book with a notional value that is higher than the GDP of the German economy.
Yeah.
So in other words, they're taking risks that are just so outsized for the culture in which they live. And it's the same thing with the big American banks too. You know, they've got massive derivatives. They've got all kinds of other risks that they're taking on because they can get away with it as gigantic, too big to fail hedge funds. Mm-hmm. So let one of those guys blow up. And that could, you know, with derivatives, it could easily happen because it only takes a small percentage of the derivatives on the books of somebody like Citibank to go out of to blow up, to take down the entire bank.
Yeah.
In which case we'd have to step back in and bail them out again because they're, you know, they're officially too big to fail. So that means a bailout is guaranteed. And, you know, in the case of these big banks, a bailout is multi-trillion dollars with no real end in sight because it's so complicated. So it could be like the bailouts of the 2000s after the housing bubble burst, but on steroids, much bigger, much crazier. And again, that shifts the focus over to the dollar. Like, do you want to own the currency of a country that's bailing out these gigantic banks? And a lot of people will say no. A lot of people are already saying no to the dollar. The de-dollarization process is already underway.
Right.
And it would be turbocharged by a bank crisis right now.
Yeah, well, certainly the 2008, 2009 started the process in some countries. The BRIC countries, I think, started to think about alternatives to the dollar when they saw the instability of the dollar system resulting from the 2008 crisis. It's a real estate. Gee, so I mean, it could really start things going. It makes sense, John. I mean, we could really be, that could really set the dominoes falling, couldn't it? And I guess, so here's a thought, here's a question for you. I had this guy, Tom Luongo, on my show a few weeks back. His view is, you know, the MMT folks, the people that would like to just turn everything over to the central banks or the government and let them run everything. And why do we need JP Morgan and Citicorp and all these big guys? Why do we need them? And Tom's view is that Jamie Dimon doesn't want to give up his job. He rather likes where he's at now. These guys aren't going to want to, so the big CEOs and the people in these large money center banks aren't going to want to give up their privilege and their power. And they are, after all, the hold the shares of the Fed, I believe. The large central money center banks are the shareholders of the Fed. So presumably they do have some influence on Fed policy. And Tom's view is that Chairman Powell is more in sync with that and doesn't want to hand this over to Davos, to the one world government. I mean, does that make any sense to you?
Well, it is true that the Federal Reserve is not part of the government. It's owned by these big banks. Yeah. And so obviously it's always going to do what's in the interest of the big banks, which means if they get into trouble, it'll find a way to bail them out. If it has to, make $2 trillion appear out of thin air and put it into the balance sheets of the big banks, it does that with a mouse click. It's not technically a hard thing to do at all.
No.
And it totally will. That's why I think the end result is the currencies. You know, that's where all of this stuff is going to land eventually.
Yeah.
Because there's no alternative or no visible alternative to the guys in charge to bailing out everybody in sight every time there's a crisis. And that just leads to more and more currency creation, which leads to more and more inflation or potential inflation, mm-hmm. which sours more and more people on these fiat currencies. So I think the death of the big fiat currencies is really the end game here. And then we do some kind of a monetary reset, and that's going to be the big battle. Do we go back to a gold standard? Or do we go full on MMT and central bank digital currency and just, have basically a monetary dictatorship in which we can't do things with our currency that they don't want us to do, because otherwise our currency will just evaporate and we'll be personally bankrupt, you know? And that's a very consequential debate that's going to happen when we have to decide to go back, either back to the past and revitalize the Constitution, which called for sound money and limited government, or go full on high tech dictatorship.
Yeah.
And the odds aren't looking good for going back, but I think we definitely have to fight that battle. There's no question that we got to try to reinstitute limited government and sound money. It's going to be very difficult, though.
It's going to be very difficult, John, but so we've had this, you know, the Austrian concept of Bauer investment. When you have interest rates at zero for 10 years or near zero, it's created a huge amount of trouble. You mentioned the commercial banks, the commercial real estate, But you know, you could go to all kinds of other industries as well where there's been malinvestment, and then so you have all of these what you call zombie companies that have been kept alive on a respirator of zero interest rates for so many decades. That has really done a lot of damage to our economy because it's steered us away from the things we have to have, we need to have as a society. So I saw that you recently wrote an article, let's start building that copper portfolio. Are you suggesting, John, that because of the shortages that were created by this malinvestment, that we're going to have to go back to, that the laws of supply and demand will require us to go back to making stuff again, going back to a basic foundation of making things that we have to have, and is the higher interest rate regime that Chairman Powell is putting into place is helping us to get there possibly?
Well, the copper story isn't so much a monetary story as it is technological. We've decided as a global civilization that we're going to electrify.
Yeah.
That is, we're going to phase out fossil fuels in favor of solar power, and we're going to phase out internal combustion engines in favor of electric cars. And that takes a lot of wiring to do that. If you look at the numbers, to get from, say, here to 50% penetration of the auto market by electric cars, all of those things take a lot of copper. So copper is one of the beneficiaries of that story. So if we're going to try to do that, which most of the governments of the world are committed to electrifying, that means we got to get the materials from somewhere. And right now there's nowhere near enough copper coming from today's mines to satisfy that demand, which means we got to get more mines going, and we got to get way more copper out of the ground than we're getting now. And to do that, you need higher prices, right? Because at today's prices, all the mines are operating that are worth running, because we've found most of the copper that's there to be found. Mm-hmm. And it's just a question of how expensive it is to get it out of the ground. So if it's too expensive at today's prices, prices have to go up to get that copper. So that's the copper story in a nutshell, that there's going to be rising demand, which is going to lead to higher prices, which is going to make the guys who already have copper in the ground a lot more valuable. So the best quality copper miners are going to become very hot stocks over the next 10 or 20 years as these big plans play out. Now, the things that could derail that are, that nuclear war that we're on the verge of, or some kind of a gigantic depression that happens because all the banks blow up and we have a currency crisis. Those are reasonably possible things. So right. the copper story is not a lock, but barring some kind of absolute catastrophe, copper will be in demand for as far as the eye can see, and the best copper miners will be good investments.
You know, John, you say most of the countries around the world are committed to this green movement, this Green New Deal, whatever. But is that true, though, really, of some of the developing countries? We look at China and India and elsewhere. I mean, China is supposed to be building one new coal-fired power plant a week or something like that. They are continuing to buy, and use petrol fuels, all the things we're not supposed to be doing, they seem to be doing. Maybe they're giving lip service to the to clean air, to the politically correct ideas of the West, but those countries are now providing the things that we need to a great extent, the raw materials that we need. We're not producing here because we've directed our economy in a different direction. So the things that we need, like copper, for example, is just one example of metals that are required to make the Green New Deal a reality. So
yeah.
what I'm getting at is, do you think it's possible that there's going to be not just copper, but other industrial or mining minerals that are going to have to be sought after, uranium potentially, if we actually go to more to nuclear power plants, which I think is on the drawing board to an extent, at least in the Biden administration. But do you have any thoughts about that? Or do we see a transition? I guess what I'm getting at, do we see a transition towards a different kind of an economy, one that's more basic to human needs in America?
Well, yeah, we're heading into a big commodity super cycle,
Right.
Where in relation to the size of the global economy, commodities become a bigger and bigger deal. And uranium, which you mentioned, is probably the best story out there because it's relatively non-cyclical. What happened was a lot of countries decided they were going to phase out coal and nuclear and natural gas in favor of solar and wind. And they started to do that, but they found out that you can't run an entire economy on solar and wind unless you're in a place where solar and wind are ideal. In other words, if you're in a sunny, windy place, those things are great. But if you're in like Germany, for instance, where it's cloudy and not that windy, solar and wind cannot be your entire economy. So a lot of countries which mothballed or closed down or eliminated plans for nuclear plants are switching back to building more nuclear plants, bringing the mothballed ones back online. China has a huge backlog of or a huge pipeline of nuclear plants that are coming online. And here again, there's not enough uranium coming out of the ground via today's mines to satisfy all that demand. But once you build a nuclear plant, you've got to feed it.
Right.
So all these plants that are being built, even in a recession, you don't normally turn off a nuclear plant. You shut down all the variable stuff. You know, it's easier to close a coal-fired plant or a natural gas pipeline than it is to turn off a nuclear plant.
Right.
So we'll run our nuclear plants regardless. We'll have to feed them with uranium, and there's not enough uranium right now. So that means we've got to find more uranium, and higher prices have to happen. So the today's uranium miners that have high quality reserves in stable places are probably going to be great investments again. So they are, a lot of them are in the five bagger to maybe even 10 bagger territory. So the a portfolio of good quality uranium stocks would probably be one of the best things you could have going forward.
Yeah. Do you have any names in mind?
Well, I'm creating a portfolio on my Substack,
and all right.
I started with the big names. There's one called Cameco.
Sure, that's the big
one. They're like the Exxon of uranium, but it's a really high quality company with good uranium mines, and they just bought a big chunk of Westinghouse, which services and builds nuclear reactors. So now that makes them kind of a one-stop shop for the industry. And then below that are a lot of pretty good miners that that over time ought to grow into really significant uranium producers. And then at the same time, there are Sprott, I think, has three ETFs that cover various aspects of the uranium industry. And one of them is a physical uranium trust.
Right.
That is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy where they go out and they borrow money and they buy uranium and they take it off the market.
Right.
And by taking it off the market, they raise the price, which raises the ETF stock price, which allows them to go finance more uranium purchases and so on. So they're a big factor in the uranium market now without actually producing any uranium. They're just borrowing money to buy it and then making the price go up in the process. So that's kind of an interesting, I'm not sure that should be legal, but it is a really good business model within the uranium and really within any market. You know, all these ETFs that buy physical basically have the same business model and the same process, whether it's gold or silver or uranium. And Sprott is really good at building those kinds of things. And Sprott also has a large uranium mining ETF and a small uranium miner ETF. So you can basically get exposure to this industry with three mouse clicks within the Sprott universe, you know? So it's a very easy industry to invest in to begin with.
John, just for a moment, going back to copper, you mentioned a name, Southern Copper, in one of your Substack articles, or would you care to comment on that company? I think they're paying a dividend of 4% or 5%, 4.5% or something like that.
Yeah, it's U.S.-based copper company that has assets in Peru and Mexico, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's got the largest copper reserves in the world of any company.
Yeah.
So it both has the ability to produce at its current level for a really long time, or it has the ability to ramp up production more quickly than most other companies in response to higher prices. It makes pretty good money doing what it's doing right now. It has a really nice dividend, so it pays you to wait until the copper story really gets going. Mm-hmm. Its only downside is political risk, because yeah. Latin America is not, for instance, Canada or Nevada or someplace like that, where you're pretty sure things are going to be okay. Yeah. It's probably okay where they are in Latin America, but that's not 100% guaranteed. Yeah. And that, I would say, is really the only drawback to a stock like that. So if you're okay with a little bit of political risk, there's an awful lot that's good about a stock like Southern Copper. So that right. was the one I started with in building the copper portfolio on, uh-huh. on our Substack. Uh-huh. And over time, I'll add four or five more companies kind mm. of in consultation with the subscriber base, because they have a lot of good ideas about things like this.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. That's another reason to sign up for John's Substack service. I guess maybe in finishing off here, I want to answer the question of the day, and that is, can gold rise in a bear market? I mean, in a recession, I guess, is the question we had. And I guess maybe I'd first like to ask you, do you think that we're heading for a recession this year yet, John?
I absolutely do think we're heading for a recession. There's an awful lot going on under the surface right now. You know, we talked about the commercial real estate issue. And even leaving that aside, a lot of banks are dramatically tightening their lending standards, because yes. they're worried about what they're seeing, which means they don't want to lend to any but their very best customers, which means a lot less money is going to be borrowed and spent by small businesses out there. And at the same time, a lot of other stuff under the surface is happening that is, interest rates are up. Yeah. The money supply is shrinking. These are the kinds of things that normally... and housing, a different branch of real estate is seeing really slow growth, and car sales are way down. It goes on and on. There's a lot of different reasons to think that the economy is going to slow in the year ahead. So I think we get a recession before the year is out. And I think that the question will be not how do we get out of this, but is it going to be a normal recession or a really extreme recession? In other words, a 1 or 2 year thing that we get out of without too much trouble, or something like 2008, 2009, where the global financial system has a near death experience. And I think that second option is completely feasible with the world being as leveraged as it is. So this could start out as something that looks like a garden variety recession, but could turn into something very serious, which means the central banks of the world will be back to easing aggressively before we know it.
Yeah. Again, it's a currency issue. So the question is not, I guess, can the price of gold rise in a recession? Obviously, if the Fed starts bailing out, starts pumping money, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, it goes up probably relative to the dollar. But that's not that gold is going up, it's the dollar is being destroyed.
Yeah. Well, see, normally in a recession, you get an equities bear market, and that pulls gold and silver down with it.
Yes.
And if this is a normal recession, then that's what will happen too. Gold and silver will go down, the miners will get whacked, and they'll bounce off that V bottom and come back strong. But this time around, because there are sectors that look like they might blow up even before we trip into a recession, and that's going to spook the governments of the world into aggressively bailing out, for instance, the local and regional banks, or maybe the big banks if their derivatives blow up, and commercial real estate and the insurance companies. A lot of big bailouts are liable to happen there. And that might possibly spook bank depositors, mm-hmm. Who've already seen a mini crisis, into pulling out their deposits and looking for safer places to put it. That could be just under the mattress. But then if there's going to be inflation because of all these bailouts, do you want cash under your mattress? No, yeah. Maybe not. So maybe gold and silver is the place to hide out from the incipient banking crisis. And so that might be something that drives gold and silver higher while we tip into a recession, because all the deposit money flowing out of banks is going to go into safe haven assets. So mm-hmm. that's a possibility, and it's one reason why you don't want to get completely out of precious metals if you think a recession is coming, because you'd miss that nice run, So you have to have to consider both possibilities, which means you probably should just continue with the dollar cost averaging that you should be doing it anyhow, you know, buy so many dollars worth of gold and silver per month, and just don't worry about macro things at all. You know, just keep on with your dollar cost averaging. If gold and silver tank, then that month you will buy more with the same number of dollars. And if it goes up, then you'll be glad you held on. And that's all I can say. You know, there's no guarantees in this kind of
situation. Guarantees in this life at all, John, I must say, and everything. But even if we have a garden variety recession, even so coming out, and at the bottom, you know, there's going to be some monetary stimulus probably that lifts the metals up as well. So even if it's a typical recession, which I tend to doubt, given all the things you've mentioned and many others in the show have mentioned, it looks like, well, we've always seen gold and silver, gold especially, as an insurance policy, right? So you need to own, start with the metals, and then the miners, as Frank Holmes pointed out recently on this show, it was the 1930s when Americans weren't allowed to own gold. And so they took the proceeds when they turned their gold into the government, took the proceeds and bought mining stocks. Homestake and some of the Canadians did extremely well. Homestake was just amazingly profitable. I think when the Dow went down 90%, Homestake tripled or something like that and paid huge dividends. So never know, past is not prologue, but it makes sense, I think, from history. We want to own the precious metals, John. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah.
Other than people should definitely go to Substack.
Yeah, definitely visit me on Substack. But I think that we're heading, and this, remember, this is earnings season now too, right?
Yeah.
So we're heading into a probably really volatile time. And volatility is to be expected as leverage grows and more and more industries suffer from being too leveraged. And so I think you should just expect that. Don't be freaked out by the stock market doing really erratic things.
Yeah.
And remember that the overall shift from financial assets to real assets, that's in place. That's going to go on for another decade at least. And just try to position yourself so that you are in the stream of where all the other money is flowing, and you do that with gold, silver, farmland, oil, uranium, things like that. There's lots of things you can buy to make this an actually a pretty good time. As crazy as it will be for most people, it can be great if you place the right bets at the right time.
Well, that's what we mean by turning hard times into good times, John. Thanks for that. All right. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us again, John, and we'll look to do it again sometime in the not too distant future, hopefully.
Thanks, Jay.
All right, folks, well, don't go away. Dr. Mark Thornton will be with me in just a moment to talk about his views on gold and the American economy. And can gold rise? Can the price of gold rise in a recession? We'll ask Dr. Thornton as well, so don't go away. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Dr. Mark Thornton with me once again. I guess it's been a few years ago we had Dr. Thornton on, and it's really good to have him back with us. He is an economist, Austrian school economist, so a very rare species, I must say. Not too many Austrian economists around. It seems they're outnumbered probably 1,000 to 1 by the Keynesians. He has been a professor of economics at Auburn University, and well, he is now a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. It's really an honor to have him with us today. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Thornton.
Hey, Jay, it's great to be back on your program. It has been a long time since I've been on. I watch your program every week.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear.
But I haven't been on, and I remember distinctly, it's been so long ago that we were talking about deflation.
Well, I it seems as though some deflation would be in order, perhaps in the financial sector. We should let the markets decide that rather than the politicians, I suppose. That's one thing that separates us from the Keynesians, I suppose, more than anything. But we'll get into that perhaps. And in fact, maybe start out by having you define Austrian economics, maybe compare it with the Keynesian school of thought, and maybe the monetarist as well. Just what's, how does Austrian's economics stand out from those other two?
Well, that's a great question. You know, Austrians believe that inflation is a monetary phenomenon of artificially increasing the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and deflation is an artificial restriction on the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very, very different from the Keynesians, who believe everything is demand led, mm-hmm. whether the consumer is buying or the government's going into debt. You know, that's viewed as highly positive from a Keynesian perspective. And deflation is an outright phobia of Keynesians and macroeconomists generally. They believe it's the equivalent of being absorbed by a black hole. And so, you know, we differ tremendously on that basis. Deflation, the normal deflation is an ordinary common phenomenon of a free market economy where prices are going down as we become more and more efficient and productive on the supply side of the economy. Now, of course, the Chicago people view inflation as a monetary phenomenon. And of course, you know, Milton Friedman is a libertarian. So we have, you know, a good bit in common at that end of the Chicago school, but the Chicago school is really a conservative viewpoint in that it takes the establishment sort of line on most things. The business communities and the political elites line on things. And since Milton Friedman, they very much adopted the methodology of the Keynesian approach, the Phillips curve, aggregate supply and demand, balanced budget, you know, multipliers and all of that, which we consider nonsense. The Chicago school, especially in the heyday of Friedman, they were fully immersed. And that's what, you know, he actually, part of his Nobel prize was an elevation of Keynesian thought, really. So we're very, very different. Sometimes it's hard to communicate with one another because we are using different words and different terms, but we come from, you know, basically completely different perspectives on the economy and economic performance and especially monetary policy.
Mm-hmm. So really, we've not that much of an influence out of the monetarists, if I'm hearing what you're saying. I mean, I remember very well Milton Friedman's views and his words, and he was very much aware that he blamed the, you know, excessive money creation as the reason for the inflation of the 70s. And, you know, that was something you didn't hear very much from the Keynesians, for sure. So the Keynesians just think it's just as long as you can stimulate demand, that's all you need. They don't seem to care if there's anything out there to buy, if there's any supply side. They don't seem to think that's important, and I can't understand why they would ignore that. How can they not see that? I mean, we've seen it with the this, you know, with all of the problems we've had after COVID, the supply problems, the constrictions of supply, and then, you know, from COVID, and then the war in the Ukraine, and trillions of dollars pumped into the system, and all of a sudden, about the time Mr. Biden takes over, the CPI starts to go up like a rocket. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's rocket science. You would think it should be understandable by somebody with a sixth grade education.
Yeah, and you know, they believe that the important elements of the economy are psychological. And yeah. So, you know, businesses invest and expand or contract based on a psychological reasoning. You know, they have the animal spirits in play and the liquidity trap threatening underneath. So there's really isn't an economic understanding of the economy. They, you know, believe that the psychological forces are the ultimate determining forces, and those psychological forces, rather than being constricted in some way by reality, are actually reinforcing. So if things get going on the downside, they don't see any way out.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another black hole.
Yeah.
And I have to admit that it with the Chicago School economist back then, or even now, at least they tend to be dealing with real issues or mm-hmm. real aspects. They like, you know, to use technological rather than psychological reasoning, but technology is an economic force
yeah.
in society. So, you know, my criticisms are harsher, I would say, on the Keynesians, and because Chicago economists tend to deal at least with reality.
Right.
And they also tend to be more free market, so that I could yeah. point to at least a couple of people at the University of Chicago now,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you have people like George Stigler, mm-hmm. Gary Becker, and Milton Friedman, all Nobel Prize winners, and they're all retired and dead by now.
Mm-hmm.
But they still do have people that are generally considered supporters of the free market. So it's in my mind right now, it's a stair stepping down where the Austrians are searching for the best view of how the economy works. And we've done a pretty good job
mm-hmm.
over the last 150 years. And the Chicago School is really a step down from that.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to things like the quantity theory and the Phillips curve, you know,
yeah.
or equally unrealistic views of the macroeconomy as being, you know, purely rational and having rational expectations so that everything is going to work out just perfectly. And then the Keynesians are really a step below that. They're really old-fashioned mercantilists.
Yeah.
Economists before Adam Smith
yeah.
and who just advocated more and more money, you know, to solve any problem.
Right.
And anybody with common sense out there knows if they are told what Keynesian economics is ultimately about, they realize it's just nonsense.
Right.
It doesn't reflect reality.
Yeah. Well, they're not told for the most part. When I did my bachelor's degree in economics at Rutgers University, I was given the Keynesian school of thought. I learned about the Austrians outside of the university environment. So I guess is there any hope that somebody will start seeing the light? I mean, the people don't make the connection between the problems that we're seeing right now. Maybe I'd like to just ask you if you can maybe talk a little bit about Keynesian economics. I think you sort of alluded to it, but you know, we have these huge deficits that can never be repaid right now. We've got interest rates that I think Chairman Powell, in my view, is trying to restore some semblance of market price discovery by the markets in terms of interest rates. Do you think there's any hope that when things, you know, if the wheels fall off the wagon, are people going to understand why? That's the question. I mean, why do things break down? Have we learned anything, for example, from 2008? I don't think the mainstream has learned much of anything.
Well, I think you're right, Jay, but I do have reasons for optimism. I think that there are more people who are open-minded now about the economy and the government moving forward. I think that more and more people have had a negative experience with government in various ways. And with this generation, this next banking crisis and economic crisis is going to hit quick enough so that most Americans will have seen this crisis as it unfolds, the previous housing bubble and financial crisis, and maybe, you know, those people in retirement saw the tech bubble and the tech meltdown. And so they do have more experience. And then this COVID business adversely affected, continues to adversely affect, destroyed the lives of millions of people.
Yes.
You know, and caused all sorts of enormous increases in, you know, the social indicators of health, family formation, suicide, all of those things that you don't discuss at a cocktail party. You know, all of those things were very negative and increased enormously in starting in 2020. And, you know, and now people are directly linking, maybe not all of the inflation that we've seen, you know, over the last 10 years, but certainly they're fully aware that the government was spending huge amounts of money. They were borrowing more than $1 trillion every year and have and continued to do so. And that the Fed was, you know, have been keeping interest rates at zero for their policy rate for the longest time. So people's exposure and their experience have made them much more open-minded, much less trusting of the government and other authorities, public health officials, the scientific community, the environmental community. The level of distrust in all of those areas has at least inched up, if not jumped up.
Yeah.
And it's our job here at the Little Mises Institute to try to demonstrate the scientific basis of their concerns. Because we can explain, you know, what the government did and what we have expected to happen for, you know, more than a century. And it's all coming out into play with large numbers.
Yeah.
You know, when the Institute was founded in 1982 by Lou Rockwell, well, you know, inflation was 12-15%, interest rates were 18-21%, unemployment was 10%. And Lou Fang, you know, establishes the Institute, and we've had 40 years of declining interest rates. We've had 40 years of low price inflation as measured by the CPI. You know, it's in that sense, it's been a little difficult for us. Now, we've grown and become much better known, but it's 40 years of that. And now we've got 2 years where the statistics that the government calculates itself are showing up really, really bad.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a turn.
So you think the cause and effect here, I mean, everybody knows that starting with Mr. Trump, you know, he pumped a huge amounts of money into the system during COVID, and then Biden, even though the economy was starting to show some signs of growth, another couple of trillion and wanted more and is ready to spend endless amounts right now. And he doesn't seem to care that the debt is piling up and can never be repaid. So do you think that maybe now, as you point out, we've had 40 years of declining interest rates, declining inflation as it's recorded, as you pointed out? I would argue that we had huge amounts of inflation, but in the financial sector, which served then to redistribute wealth from the common folks. I like to say the miners, the manufacturers, the farmers, the inventors, the people that actually produce stuff, found themselves not doing all that well. Meantime, the guys that are skimming off of the, you know, the military industrial complex, Washington, Wall Street, the bankers and so forth, have made out like bandits. And we've had this, I guess, the greatest redistribution of wealth of any time since the so-called robber barons, maybe greater, I don't know. But
yes.
So we've had this enormous amount of inflation, but in the financial markets, it's sort of good inflation, as they like to say. And now we're having bad inflation because commodity prices are going up and people that actually produce things we have to have are now starting to make some money. That's bad inflation, according to these guys. And so the propaganda is trying to obscure what is so obvious. You know, Biden takes office, you have all this money that's pumped into the system. You look at the charts, it's almost as soon as he took off, it's not entirely his fault, but as soon as he came into as president, that's when the inflation rate, the CPI, took off. I would hope that people could understand and see the correlation, where, as you say, it was difficult for 40 years to make a case for the Austrian school because everything seemed to be going along swimmingly well. It wasn't.
But it wasn't. But, you know, in terms of how the media reported it, it made it feel like everything was going well. The stock market's up. That's a big signal, even to people who don't own stock.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a tremendous misleading of the American public. But, you know, and I agree, Trump is dangerous. He doesn't really think through, you know, beyond page one.
Yeah.
What he's saying. But he is appealing to the very people who have been disadvantaged,
right,
by this system over the last 50 years, 40 years, and so on, is the people who work and the people who produce, you know, so manufacturing, mining, agriculture, your plumber, your doctor, even your lawyer. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people who are actually doing the work out there for us, they're upset. They know they've been disadvantaged now.
Yeah.
They're seeing all these fly-by-night billionaires, and yep, they're wondering, you know, how can that be? And so it's our job to explain all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know Trump will disappoint them,
yeah,
eventually, mm-hmm, as he's done already. Mm-hmm. That's the unfortunate thing. But he does, you know, he does represent the outside the beltway thinking, the outside the beltway perspective. And that is the Austrian perspective. We are the school of economics that places the entrepreneur front and center,
mm-hmm,
as the person who's responsible for gathering up resources and giving people paychecks,
mm-hmm,
and creating the next generation of goods and services, or even just creating the new label on the product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and all of that, if you look at business history, is so important to where we stand today. If not for the entrepreneur, there would be no progress. And we're also, of course, we can show and demonstrate why the capitalist and the worker and the consumer, you know, and the resource owner, they're all equally important and necessary in this cooperative process that has lifted us from mere animals.
Yeah.
You know, 10,000 years ago to where we are today, where we're worried about robots and artificial intelligence. You know, it wasn't government that did any of that.
No, absolutely not. Although, notwithstanding what former Vice President Hillary Clinton said, it's government that creates wealth, she said. You know, I don't know how that computes in anybody's brain. But anyway, maybe you could talk a little bit about Ludwig von Mises's view on gold and why that's so important. I mean, there's a reason why the Keynesians didn't like gold. The monetarists don't either. I guess they want to have control of the money supply. But even though I think Milton Friedman said something about a steady supply of money is what was required, 2-3% a year, I think he said that. And you get a 2-3% growth in the supply of gold every year. So why? But anyway, maybe talk about von Mises' understanding of gold and why it was so important to have that as the cornerstone of the monetary system.
Well, it's because money is so important. It's, you know, the creation or evolution of money in humankind, you know, is 3,000 or 4,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a relatively new phenomenon in geological terms,
mm-hmm,
but it's obviously one of the things that caused this tremendous uplift in the standard of living, and it's done what we've, you know, can see today to humanity through history. You know, all of the bad things in human history are associated with government getting involved with money.
Yeah.
And all of the good things, the countries that had good monetary systems, you saw great things happen there. And Mises was, you know, very well informed about this. His first great book, The Theory of Money and Credit, he not only laid out, you know, some of the basic institutional details, but he made theoretical breakthroughs in the economics profession. He was the first person to be able to link money with the real economy. Before that, it was just the real economy, people exchanging, you know, chickens for loaves of bread.
Barter,
essentially. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that essential system continues to this day in mainstream economics. But Mises found a missing key there in his regression theorem. He bolstered the Mengerian story of Karl Menger, mm-hmm. About the origin of money evolving in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And then he also provided history and problems with essentially with paper money or fiat money, money that was created and in somebody's pocket, but it didn't represent an original claim on gold. So he was considered to be a metalist.
Uh-huh.
In terms of money, which is kind of the strongest position on the gold standard that you can take.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, dismissed as a result of that, even though one of his greatest rivals, personal rivals, Joseph Schumpeter, mm-hmm. Said, you know, well, you know, Mises takes this position, but with good reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had good theoretical reasons for that position, and he fought his whole life for the gold standard. He, you know, put friendships even mm-hmm. on the line because of people's differing views on retaining the gold standard and whether or not the Bretton Woods standard was good enough or latent with problems that would emerge. And he was right about all this, but he was working, it's actually part of my Skyscraper book. It's in there. He was actually working, you know, into his late 80s, giving public speeches and addresses, and it all had to do with the gold standard. This is in the later 60s, when he should have been long retired. He was out there fighting.
Yeah.
And he was out there. He knew, along with Henry Hazlitt, Murray Rothbard,
they knew
what the cause was. It was too much government spending, too much government printing. They knew Bretton Woods was problematic. They knew it was in danger. And they fought tooth and nail, you know, for gold, for fixed exchange rates, and all the rest. And it, of course, didn't come to pass. But the fact that he was fighting so hard, so late in life, because of what he believed in. And the reason he believed in it was he understood economic theory. Mm-hmm. And he knew that the implications of theory could be disastrous if left into the hands of a politician who was insulated from the negative effects, insulated from reality.
Right. Right. Well, that's what we're seeing now, isn't it? We're seeing this enormous deficit, enormous debt, malinvestment all over the place. So is it possible to have a healthy capitalist system without an honest monetary system? And I suppose you would agree that silver could be also a second best money, perhaps.
Well, I love silver, and silver is really money in circulation.
Right.
Whereas gold tends to be money as a means of large purchases, international exchange, you know, it tends to get used for purchasing cars and that's it. But silver is money. In French, the word for money is the word for silver. So, and in France was the largest economy for hundreds of years. So, you can have a very good economy with problems with your money, like on Bretton Woods.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. economy was in great shape. but for a variety of reasons. It wasn't because the Fed had some scope for inflation. It was because they were restricted.
Yeah.
They couldn't inflate that much.
Right, right.
And so, yes, you can, the market economy, you know, it attempts to heal all wounds. It attempts, as a reflection of our own actions, to solve all problems. Mm-hmm. And obviously doesn't do so instantaneously, but it's always working on these problems, and it can put up with imperfections in money, and we've always recognized that, but they can be minor imperfections.
Yeah.
They can't be system-wide imperfections. They can't be things like fiat money.
Right.
And we can't even have a purely stable monetary system with you know, controlled banking, where banks can manipulate the money supply in their own favor, because that's where you get the first wrinkles mm-hmm. of the business cycle. Mm-hmm. So the better the monetary system, the better the economy, and the worse the monetary system, the worse the economy and the economic performance is going to be. We have been benefited. Mm-hmm. In the United States, speaking to your American listeners, we've had the biggest advantage since World War II, because the war wasn't fought by and large on U.S. soil. Our economy was intact after the war. All the gold was being held essentially by the U.S. after the war, because of the war. The other economies were destroyed, and we ended up being the world's military superpower. We ended up being the world's mega gold owner. And thankfully, the Keynesians were temporarily displaced after World War II. The socialists had been thrown out. Roosevelt's socialists had been thrown out by Harry Truman and Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for the background for most listeners' lives, we did have a relatively ideal situation where we were on the Bretton Woods gold standard mm-hmm. And all the rest. Now, everything has changed since then. And right. The dollar is now facing, you know, new emerging threats. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Fed is still incredibly powerful, but it is losing power and prestige, I guess mm-hmm. you'd call it in central banking terms, on a global scale.
Right. Okay, so we've mucked things up pretty badly with the, since 1971, especially, I guess, is when Richard Nixon detached gold from the dollar. And yeah, J.P. Morgan said, I think the only thing that's money is gold and everything else is credit. I guess maybe he could have put in silver into that as well, but J.P. Morgan didn't deal in chump change, I guess. And so he was thinking in terms of gold, but he seemed to understand that. Everything else is credit when you think about it. I mean, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, money is credit. The dollar is worth only to the extent that the people can pay me back when they owe me money. Otherwise, you know, my loans to someone are worthless, right?
Yeah, and that, you know, when you get down to fundamentals, gold is money. Mm-hmm. It still is. It's just been displaced in circulation by fiat money, first in terms of gold. And, you know, even the silver coins that I so dearly love and wish we had back, even they had a token element to them, because silver was in circulation. It was roughly 1/15th of an ounce of gold mm-hmm. at the market, but the in the actual market, it was really, you know, 35 to one type of an arrangement. So silver was, you know, overvalued and therefore in circulation as at a discount, but still, yeah. I mean, in the broad strokes of history, silver does serve, it has served as an incredibly useful money system. And I just love watching old movies and stuff where they the fellow's driving around London and he gets out his change person, you know, and hands the cabbie 35 cents or whatever that is in English terms.
But,
you know, and of course, unfortunately, now in modern America, you know, people who have grown up, they have no connection whatsoever with that system and how useful and valuable it was to the common man. Mm-hmm. And now we have, you know, the younger generations don't even deal in change.
Right.
You know, older people, you know, they might use cash and they might, you know, throw all their change into a bucket. But the youngest generations just use plastic cards and, you know, they never see the cash and they don't want to see the coins. And, you know, frankly, the coins are, you know, of this monetary system that we're talking about today, the coins are a type of nuisance.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, I want to just a couple of questions I'd like to ask you before we wrap up here. What you alluded to the changes that are taking place in the international monetary system, at least in the trading system, the BRICS are you know, for very logical reasons, are trying to find a way to trade amongst themselves outside of the dollar. How much of a threat do you think this is to the dollar and the United States reserve currency status? I mean, some people think it's imminent, it's going to happen fairly quickly. Others think it's, you know, I mean, I had somebody the other day telling Adam Taggart that he thinks it's another 100 or 200 years before the dollar loses its preeminence. And I don't know. I don't think reserve currencies last that long. I think they've generally lasted 70, 80 years or something like that. So I don't know where he's coming from, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think the threats to the dollar as a reserve currency, as a currency, and as a trading currency are all, they all face severe threats, mm-hmm. but there is always this inertia in markets that's in some cases backed up by military force on the part of the United States. Mm-hmm. Anybody who questions the worldwide dominance of the U.S. dollar has been dealt with pretty harshly. And, you know, so it's one of those things where no one can imagine mm-hmm. the dollar losing its eminent position. I reviewed a book by a leading mainstream economist about 15 years ago, and it was on this very issue. And he said, well, you know, the U.S. is doing everything wrong to retain this lofty status, this ability to inflate at will with low cost, but there are no competitors.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a legitimate statement, especially 15 years ago, but everything had already gotten worse for the dollar before he wrote that book, and everything has gotten worse since he wrote that book. And, you know, one of the things is simple technological changes could have a big impact. For example, there's just oodles and oodles of U.S. currency overseas,
yes.
serving illegal markets, mm-hmm. you know, the drug trade and so forth. And it's also serving in countries where, you know, they've had runaway inflation or even hyperinflation. The dollar is brought in to as a substitute currency. So if you think you've got it bad, think of what their situation is. But if there was a technological change that allowed these people access to a stable money that wasn't the U.S. dollars, you'd see their demand for dollars turn negative,
right.
and the dollars start heading back to the U.S. So,
right.
Like with the British pound, It was the world dominating currency for, you know, a few hundred years, and World War One came and went, and they had lost it.
Yeah.
So it you know, that's really 4 or 5 years, that terrible event that killed tens of millions of people, and left the world in ashes. But it also left the British pound and the British economy. It exposed all of the types of things that they did in the 19th century, and what we've did in the 20th and 21st century. It kind of exposed all of that, the debt and the spending and the power and the regulatory state and the granting of privileges that goes on ad infinitum. I think, you know, we're going to be in for a similar type event, and it's not going to be hundreds of years. It's not even going to be tens of years.
Right.
It's going to be the next big event.
Yeah, I would think so. Alistair MacLeod likes to say that the domestic economy, the people in the domestic, you know, the people that own the reserve currency are the last ones to recognize that it's in trouble. And the foreigners start to dump it. We'll be the ones that start to offload it first and lose confidence in it. And maybe that's already starting to happen. Well, I'd like to ask you, just in wrapping up, what do you see then? Do you see a sort of a real decline in the dollar? I mean, it's hard to imagine that Chairman Powell will hang tough until we get back to a free market for money, for capital. I can't imagine anybody has. I remember years ago asking Ron Paul and Mark Faber at a dinner we had in San Francisco. I mean, this was in the late 90s, long before the trouble we have now. You know, could they foresee a Paul Volcker moment again where we would see interest rates, you know, whatever it took to straighten things out again? And neither of them could imagine that was possible. And now even much more impossible, it would seem. What are your thoughts?
Well, we haven't seen that kind of extreme policy reaction pulling back at the Federal Reserve, and there's no stomach for that nowadays. Yeah. There wasn't really even stomach for that in the 1970s.
Yes.
You know, they were forced into it. You know, it was something that Murray Rothbard and Hazlitt were talking about, but their work had limited circulation, but they were calling for what he ultimately did. And it is hard to imagine. I think it's going to be forced upon them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, they're not out of the water in this cycle by any means whatsoever. I think that most of the problem is still facing them. In other words, they haven't really worked through much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk about raising rates and, you know, pressing down in inflation, but underneath that, and right now they're kind of at a pivot point, and they're hoping it's all going to go away, but it's not.
Yeah.
And it's push come to shove at that point. Do you do your normal policy and reap even more inflation and more trouble? Or do you go full Volcker on the economy? And, you know, I really don't think the political class believes that they can survive that kind of thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's going to pull, because it's going to pull down so many people in terms of businesses and households and all of the institutional fabric of society. It's fairly weak right now, I would say.
Yeah.
It's fairly distrustful.
Yeah.
It's still there. And I believe that, but I don't think they have a way out, which is, oddly enough, why I am so optimistic at this point. I think we have a great opportunity to explain economics, but I also think we have a great opportunity to, in a revolutionary sense, in a peaceful revolutionary sense, I think we have an opportunity in our lifetimes to get back onto a gold standard, because this system is clearly going to fail. It's failing people in small numbers right now, and it's going to get nothing but bigger. And I think we need to be ready for that opportunity, because if you pay attention to Washington, D.C., you know you're not going to get any good ideas. You're not going to get any real solutions out of those people.
No, for sure.
There's no way.
So we need to be ready. And what does that mean then in wrapping up? And turning hard times into good times, it's the name of our show. So can you help us do that?
Well, I think, you know, I think your audience is all set. I mean, you're talking and they're listening about real things that are monetary related, but also in the real economy, mining and things of that nature, real constraints. I mean, that's what people should be discussing. And I think more people are going to. That's what we're hoping, you know, to do here, is to educate everybody about the real economy, how the real economy functions. Everybody kind of wants the same goals. They want opportunity.
Yeah.
They want freedom of choice to be able to operate in the economy, and they're willing to fail.
Yeah.
And that's all that they want, and that's what the economy will offer if we get back to an Austrian school of economics, essentially policy-wise, and have a free market economy. That's what the free market economy has to offer, is, you know, opportunity, choice, and the possibility of success or failure. That's what turns people on.
Well, that's what turns freedom-loving people on. I have an idea that there's a lot of propaganda that suggests that there's no hope for freedom. You just have to depend on us. The government will take care of you. We'll just be, you'll have all your needs taken care of by government. We know that's a big lie. Anybody that's studied history knows that. Maybe just tell people how they can keep up with what's going on at the Mises Institute. And you write and provide information. Your articles are displayed there. How can people keep up with your work?
Well, it's hard for me to believe that there's even one of your regular listeners who's not a subscriber to Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. We have the world's largest economic library. We put out an article at least once a day. It's about the economy usually, or politics from a free market perspective. We have a bunch of great podcasts. I have it's called the Minor Issues podcast, and it's only 4 minutes long, once or twice a week. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Mark Thornton, D-R-M-A-R-K-T-H-O-R-N-T-O-N. And I'm on there on a fairly regular basis. You'll find my podcast being talked about on there. And it's the real deal.
Very good. It is a real deal. I thank you very much for being with us again, Mark. It was really good to have you. And we'll have to do it again and maybe hit on some of the main issues of the day from time to time and get your comments on them. Thank you.
I'd love that, Jay. You're very welcome.
All righty. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, Michael Oliver is going to be with me. I'm not sure. We probably will have another guest or two. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.